It is in the nature of time that men stand forever on the threshold of tomorrow. So it is with us and with our country. Even as we enjoy the fruits of today here in America, in our minds we try to see over the wall of time that divides us from the future. Tomorrow, what will it be like? We ask this question now on Image America. This is Bob Considine with the final program of our series, Image America, presented by NBC in cooperation with the Fund for Adult Education. During our series of programs, we've investigated many parts of American life, and now we turn to a summing up and to ideas and predictions about the days and the years to come. In this half hour of our final three-part program, ideas and opinions about today and some thoughts about tomorrow. First, Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Arthur Schlesinger, Jr. Mr. Schlesinger, as a historian, how would you sum up the United States today?
Well, I would say that if you take America at the turn of the century, or in 1910, which is 50 years ago, or in 1860, which is 100 years ago, one marked difference would be that in 1860 and in 1910, one had the sense of a nation still growing, still young, still filled with ideas and dedication and drive. Of course, 100 years ago, we were on the verge of a great civil war, but that civil war was fought, in Lincoln's terms, to justify the experiment in self-government. And that people were filled with pride and dedication and conviction about that experiment. I think in 1960, one senses a much older nation, a nation somewhat weary and irresolute and baffled, a nation somewhat on the defensive, a nation with an insecure, pervading anxiety that its days as a great power may be numbered and that it may have to reconcile itself to being second best. I think that this is a passing mood. I think the American people will not long accept this melancholy picture of themselves. But I think as we move into a new decade and a new epoch, that we will recover some of the vitality and confidence and dynamism and drive that we had 50 years ago and 100 years ago.
What are some of the important questions you think Americans should be asking themselves today?
Well, I think one important question is the purpose of freedom. We talk a good deal about a free society and how free we are and how wonderful it is, but we don't use our freedom particularly. I don't think we use our freedom in the sense of affording full scope for the development of individual identity. And I think we ought to consider the fact that if everybody is like everybody else and ought to be like everybody else, we ought to consider what difference there remains between us and the communists, because the communists assume that everybody is like everybody else. Our assumption, the assumption of a free society, I would suppose, is that people are different from each other and that they are justified in living out those differences. I think that's one question. Another question that seems to me of supreme importance has to do with our wealth. We are the richest nation in the history of the world. We ought to ask ourselves, to what purpose should we use our wealth? To what purpose should we apply this abundance that surrounds us? We have, in the last decade, applied this abundance to a tremendous degree to the production and consumption of consumer goods and services. As we have done this, we have inadequately supplied the public services and facilities which in the long run our national power and indeed national survival may depend, everything from education to national defense. We have, on the one hand, wallowed in consumer comfort and luxury, and on the other, not expanded our public services and facilities at a rate which makes it possible either for us to maintain effective competition with the Soviet Union or even to keep abreast of the tremendous population increase in our own country. The Soviet Union, with less than half our annual gross national product, is making much faster progress than we are in the vital categories of national power, in education, in national defense, in the intercontinental ballistic missile, in the contest for space, in the rate of economic growth. And I think we must ask ourselves whether in the use we are making of our national wealth and abundance, we are not approaching that condition of private opulence and public squalor, which in the past has always marked the decay of empires.
Mr. Schlesinger, at what moments in our history have we Americans demonstrated the best that's in us? What have been our grandest hours, let's say? And when have we failed?
Well, I would think that just to take this century of American history, that there have been several moments when American life has responded to a sense of national purpose, when our activities have been controlled by a feeling of national priorities, and when we've made constructive and potent contributions to the world. One of them was in the Progressive period under the presidency of Theodore Roosevelt. Another was in the second decade of the century under the presidency of Woodrow Wilson. Another period was in the time of the New Deal in the 30s. Another period was during the Second World War in the 40s. I think anyone who has lived through or has read about these periods will recognize that in these periods, American life was controlled by a sense of higher purpose to which individual and group interests were cheerfully subordinated. I think that there have been periods where this has not been the case. I think, for example, no one writing about the 1950s is ever going to give a book about the 1950s, the title which Winston Churchill gave one of his books about the Second World War. No one's going to call the history of the U.S. in the 1950s our finest hour. It clearly has not been our finest hour. It's been a decade instead of drift and self-indulgence and self-righteousness in which, because we have lacked a sense of animating national purpose, we have permitted our national strength to dissipate in relation to that of our chief competitor in the world. And I think what we require above all is a recovery of the kind of sense of national purpose we had in the 30s and 40s and that we had in the first two decades of this century. And for reasons that I've already suggested, because of what seems to me this inherent cyclical rhythm in our national affairs, I believe that the time is ripe in the 1960s for a recovery of the sense of national purpose. And in such an epoch, we Americans will once again demonstrate the best of which we are capable.
Thank you. Arthur Schlesinger, Jr., a summing up of where we stand today from the viewpoint of an historian. Professor Kenneth Galbraith of Harvard, who has taken a close look at the American present in his book, The Affluent Society, looks at the future right now. Professor Galbraith, where do we go from here?
Well, I should hope first that we would begin to take a more rational and self-conscious view of the direction in which we're moving. There has been a notion in recent times, perhaps since World War II, that kind of a rejection of planned and purposeful thought about our course. We must get back to that. We must think in terms of the plans, goals of our economy and of our society.
What goals, for example?
I would hope that, first of all, those who are still poor, those who are still in a state of physical deprivation, might be brought up to the comparative well-being of the rest of the community.
Professor, what exactly are we going to do for the considerable number of people who are still poor, even in our affluent society? How can we see to it that they get on the bandwagon, let's say?
Well, I think the important thing, the one thing of which we should make absolutely certain, is that their children do. I should hope that these children would have access to first-rate schools. One of the reasons that poverty is self-perpetuating in some parts of the country is that the children of poor parents have only poor schools available to them. Their health is not first rate. And they come to industrial employment handicapped by poor nutrition, poor teeth, poor physical preparation. Some part of the problem of poverty is in the lag in our mental health facilities. Some part of it is the result of the backwardness in eliminating the squalor of our cities and the tendency for poor people to be jammed together in the slums and for this to be self-perpetuating. In sum, in the aggregate, I would think that this problem, more than anything else, requires the development and extension of our public services, education, health, urban redevelopment, housing, and that these are the great progressive prospect for helping the people who are at the lowest level of the income ladder to, in the next generation, become self-supporting.
All right, sir. That's one goal, and certainly an important one. But then what? What will the goals of all of us be?
Everyone, of course, defines these goals for himself, and I certainly wouldn't want to present mine as absolute, but I should imagine, I should hope that the making of a living, the acquiring of physical goods, would become a smaller and smaller part of our weekly or monthly or yearly effort, that we would have more and more time for an increasingly wide range of leisure activities, which would include a wide range of cultural and artistic activities. These have always been the great source of enjoyment for people. They have been in the past the source of enjoyment of an elite. I don't think it's unreasonable to suppose that they should now become the great source of enjoyment and fulfillment for all people.
Thank you. Kenneth Galbraith, from the author of The Affluent Society, some thoughts about the future of the society. Senator Stuart Symington of Missouri answers this for us. Senator, what questions should Americans be asking themselves in this opening year of a new decade?
Well, some are, what are we going to do and how are we going to accomplish the furtherance of world peace in freedom and under law? And what kind of an example are we setting in our daily life here in the United States, the richest, the strongest, the finest country in the world? How can we obtain still greater economic growth would be another a question that we should ask ourselves, because the fact that many of our people have an unprecedented prosperity doesn't rule out or, in fact, nevertheless rules in the additional fact that many of our people are in distress. How are we going to have a more equitable distribution of income without inflation and without unnecessary government controls? And then, of course, one of the grave problems which we face, especially as we look outside of our country at what's going on abroad, is this problem of the education of our youth. What are we going to do about that? We talk a lot about it, but why are we 140,000 classrooms behind and plan to stay that way? How much faith do we have in the American way of life? How are we going to express that faith practically in the undeveloped countries and all uncommitted countries? I know, and you know, that we have that faith, but how are we going to express it? And the way, because in my opinion, the way we express it may result in the future of our children, their freedom, and their happy life.
Another answer to the same question comes to us from Senator Jacob Javits of New York. Senator, what questions should Americans be asking themselves at the present time?
Well, Bob, it seems to me we should be asking ourselves the following. One, what can we do the best to keep peace in the world? Two, what can we do the best to help lead the world toward free institutions? Three, what can we do the best toward helping in our own country to realize the benefit of all our enormous resources for all our people and the ideals of our Republican and the democratic society insofar as all the people are concerned? And finally, what can we do to in some way convey this tremendous capability of the Industrial Revolution to the people of the less developed areas of the world? And as a key to what else we should be asking ourselves, I would like to add, are we doing enough in terms of our own self-discipline, in terms of our own understanding, in terms of our own educational system, in terms of equal opportunity, which is so often called civil rights, to give every American that sense of dignity and that sense of belonging, which represents marshaling the full power of our country. Is every employer of labor sure that he is, in his own business, which is in itself a little government, carrying out those policies which are the most conducive to the best development of his working people and to the best future for his particular industry? Are all working people doing their utmost to see that our country produces to the maximum? Are Americans prepared to go out into the world as workers in industry and as workers for government, or even as soldiers, for the purpose of ensuring that the ideals of freedom and of equal opportunity become the whole world's ideas, instead of being confined as they are today to some parts of the free world, by no means all? In terms of our domestic economic situation, what are we prepared to do in terms of broadening the opportunities for education, for health, for culture, for housing? What sacrifices are we prepared to make if sacrifices are required? I sum up by saying that the deep understanding, the dedication, the internal discipline, the willingness to do, these are the questions, I think, which every American must ask himself, because I am deeply convinced that in the rest of this 20th century, we can either assure or destroy the brightest hopes for freedom and well-being and self-realization that mankind has ever had since the dawn of history.
Thank you, Senator Javits. We live in an era where everything is getting more complex. Some people believe that this complexity poses a real problem for all of us. For an opinion on this, we go now to Dean Harlan Cleveland of the Maxwell Graduate School of Citizenship and Public Affairs in Syracuse.
We haven't yet learned to live with this this complexity. We can see this in our cities. There isn't anything we don't know about the economics of the city, the sociology of the city, the population problem in the city, the marketing and business problem of the city. But what we haven't learned how to do is to put it all together. We've learned to be experts on everything, except the process of putting the experts together to make something happen. Now, similarly, in our international affairs, we tend to be experts on what we think, what we Americans think, what's in our interest. But we're not yet experts enough in how to put our interests together with other nations' interests to fashion international institutions that will be a better basis for world order than sovereign nations can ever be in the long run. So what have we done? We've tended to build international organizations of an expert or specialized character. We set up an international organization to worry about food and agriculture, and another one to worry about world health, and another one to worry about science and culture and education, and another one to worry about children, and another one to worry about money, International Monetary Fund. Now, the people who work in all of these organizations have the experience that they can get along fine with their opposite numbers. The agricultural people get along fine with the agricultural people in other countries. But again, we haven't found the way in international affairs of tying these various experts together. Now, this is sort of the international aspect of what of our trouble in our cities or in other aspects of our own domestic life here. It's the fact that we know a lot about a lot of specific subjects, but we haven't yet learned very much about how to put the specific subjects together.
Thank you, Dean Cleveland, for an interesting comment on the growing complexity of the world in which we live. We have the experts, we have all kinds of knowledge, but as yet, as you point out, we haven't seemed able to use all of this for practical solutions. Thank you. Let's turn now to Irwin Kenham, editor of the Christian Science Monitor, a newspaper that has long been considered and is one of the finest in the country. Mr. Kenham, could you give us some of your ideas about the United States in relation to the rest of the world? For example, what do you think are the most important international problems we must try to solve in the future? Would you answer this for us?
Yes. A first problem, of course, is the relations of the communist and the non-communist world, a stabilization of those relations so that they are not hostile. Second, and closely related to the first, is the problem of what is called disarmament, which should really mean the limitation and the control of the suicidal tools of destroying one another's society, some form of armaments control. A third necessity is to stabilize our relations with communist China, which is one of the most formidable and menacing elements in the world. The problem of communist China must be faced. We must face our relations with Western Europe, particularly with our economic relations with Western Europe, the inner six and the outer seven nations, these new economic groupings with which we must work out a satisfactory economic relationship. We must achieve, I think, and I think we can achieve, a better Atlantic community. There is a lot of fellow feeling around the Atlantic basin, nations that like-minded, nations with much in common. I think we should build on that to get an international grouping which has a far greater cohesion than any other international grouping. And South America, Latin America, is potentially part of that same picture. We have too greatly neglected our Latin American relations for too long a time. Another great necessity is sound, vigorous international trade. There is dangers that the competition from overseas, cheaper conditions and costs of production in other European countries will, and in Japan, will encourage high tariff barriers in the United States, which would make bad matters worse. So the problem of international trade is essential to the problem of peace. And there is the problem of the development of underdeveloped nations in the world, the nations which are awakening in Asia and Africa and knocking on the doors of society for their day in the sun, relations with them so that they will look to the kind of system of freedom which we hope to make real and vital and want to choose some parts at least of free society as their way of life as they progress. And then the problem of international race relations. The tinted races of the world, the brown people and the yellow people and the black people, far outnumber the white people. And we have got to treat them with dignity and respect and learn to live with them on a basis of true peace, of true mutuality of interest and respect. The problem of international race relations, I think, is a very real problem in this whole list, and I could go on, but that's enough for now. That's if we make a significant contribution to only two or three of these problems, we will have done a good deal.
How about our domestic problems?
One of our most pressing domestic problems is that of good government at all levels, city, state, national, and particularly the participation of better people in government. I don't say this invidiously regarding the people who are now in government. Many of them are dedicated, able, and magnificent people, but there are not enough of them. We need in government in this nation our most intelligent, our most honest, and our most dedicated and responsible people. And now I'll hurry on with some other domestic problems. Problem of economic growth, of curbing inflation, problem of tax reform, a tax system that will stimulate a growing, expanding economy. The problem of race relations and of other civil rights. The problem of a better educational system, a more rigorous, a more practical, a more demanding, a more effective educational system. The problem of rebuilding our cities, which are falling apart and in the downtown areas and which are sprawling out into the suburbs and have to be integrated and brought together, and order and discipline and progressive cooperation needs to be introduced into our vast urban messes. The problem of population and growth. By 1965, we'll have to be finding at least 25,000 new jobs every week. Well, the kids who began to be born around 1945 and will be coming into the labor market by 1965, we've got to have growth in order to assure a strong and prosperous economy. It's been assumed by too many people that a growing population automatically ensured prosperity. If that were true, India would be the most prosperous country in the world today. It isn't. You've got to have not only growth of population, but you've got to have jobs. You've got to create jobs, and jobs will be produced, can only be produced by the investment of capital, by money, by funds, and planning and expansion of industry and so on to create these jobs. And finally, my last point about domestic problems, I would say a better national morale, a sober and very earnest dedication to the real, lasting, and true values which make a good society.
Some people say we lack a national purpose. Would you comment on this?
I am a little mistrustful of the phrase, a sense of national purpose. Mr. Hitler and the communists talk a good deal about a sense of national purpose. And this can be a trick of the dictator, a delusion, an intoxicant of the police state. I think that our sense of national purpose is really a sense of individual purpose, that our nation is a composite of individual people. Its sole importance lies in the significance of the individuals who make it up. And so if we have a purpose, and I'd like to call it, if you call it a national purpose, call it a purpose for a nation of peoples, of individuals, it is the fulfillment of the rights of man. It is assuring man a greater opportunity to carry out his birthright, to carry out his opportunity to improve himself and to build a better world in which we have, in which he lives. National purpose is not a monolith set up by some dictator. National purpose is the total of individual purposes, and the total of individual purposes is the betterment of the lot and the being of individual man.
Thank you, Mr. Canham, the editor of the Christian Science Monitor, with some extremely important ideas. In our program, we're hearing many ideas about the future of our country, and we'll hear many more. But at the close of this first half hour, we pause to think for a moment about some of the ideas we've already heard. They're not simple ideas, but then we don't live in a simple world anymore. There was a time when a man's world was limited by the boundaries of his farm or his village. Today, the boundaries have stretched to the ends of the earth and even beyond. We are all personally involved in what goes on in all parts of our country, and indeed in all parts of the world. An informed citizenry is the keystone of a democracy, and even if it is increasingly difficult to become informed and to stay informed on all issues, it's still our responsibility, our best way to future greatness.
This is the NBC Radio Network.